Today is Thursday, April 12. It is 9:30 a.m., and this is panel number 4003, entitled Brazen Political Lying, the New Normal. I'm Albert Hand. I'm a retired Wall Street lawyer who moved from New York to Boulder 14 years ago. A little housekeeping, please silence your devices. We have three distinguished panelists. I'm going to introduce them in the order in which they're going to speak. First of all is Joe Sexton. He's a journalist, senior editor of ProPublica, was formerly with the New York Times. If you want to know more about him or any of the other two panelists, there are biographies in the program. Second is Robert George. He's a New York journalist. He's on the editorial board of the New York Post. And Margot Squire.
It's Daily News now. Used to be the Post, now the Daily News.
Oh, excuse me. Right, it's the Daily News. That's right. Right. My fault.
All right, we're starting with a fucking lie already. Where is this headed?
We're but it's not brazen. at least I don't think so. And Margot Squire, who is a career diplomat. The order of business, each panelist will make an opening statement of about 10 minutes or so. And after that, the panelists will talk amongst themselves, let you listen, of course, as things may have come up in their presentations. Another panelist may have something to comment on, and we'll go through that. And at the end, we will leave some time for questions and answers. There are no microphones, which is a great improvement at the Conference on World Affairs. In this session, my computer is broken, you may have submitted questions on the app. I can't access them. I'm sorry. That's just the way it is. So,
Albert, is your computer really broken?
It is really broken. It is really broken, yes. Well, it's not broken. It won't respond, which is broken, right? So what we're going to do is receive questions via the note card system. Our producer, Nancy Lee, is right over there. And if you want a note card and a pencil, just raise your hand. She will give you a note card and a pencil. And when you're through writing your question down, raise your hand, and she will come by and pick them up. I have one further announcement, which I will read. I have never done this before. Before we turn to audience questions, well, I should have done this later, I guess, but here it is. We would like to quickly mention the CWA 70th crowdfunding campaign. To celebrate CWA's 70th year, we have set a goal to raise $70,000. We are one quarter of the way to our goal, and we would appreciate your support. Any amount helps. You can give by selecting the donate button in your app or visiting the CWA website. All of that taken care of. The first of our panelists to speak is Joe Sexton right here.
Good morning. Is this working? I know there's a suspicion among people in Boulder that, you know, people have overstated our concerns about our borders and, you know, who is actually getting through them and whatever. How the fuck a retired corporate lawyer get into Boulder? All right? Let's get to work on the border protection. All right, I ain't gonna lie. I have my doubts about the lasting value of this panel. Or perhaps just my own modest contributions to it. I started counting the number of Trump panels at this year's CWA, and I quit after I got to 9 because I had to actually hustle over here on time. I could have gone on. There were another half dozen that were sort of generally aimed at Trump. And look, maybe that's right. Maybe the moment demands it. But this particular one on lying and brazen lying strikes me as maybe the least novel and, I don't know, maybe not that interesting. So I'm going to try to have a little fun And maybe turn the question around a little bit and invite your participation in answering this. Why are we, as both a species and citizens of the United States, so uninterested in the truth? I could tell you, for instance, that Donald Trump's lying had led to a poll showing 75% of all Americans didn't believe their politicians. But that would be a lie. The poll was from 2010. I could tell you that a national news organization had won a Pulitzer Prize for chronicling all of Donald Trump's lies. But that, too, would be a lie. The politician was Hillary Clinton, and the Pulitzer was in 2008. Anyway, I could play this somewhat somber game forever, but let's confront it. Brazen lying. One of the questions I had is, why should we regard brazen lying as more of a menace than its alternatives, like clever lying, effective lying, consequential lying? Bill Moyers, turns out, did a book years back called 935 Lies, The Future of Truth and the Decline of America's Moral Integrity. The 935 lies were the number of times George Bush and Dick Cheney had lied in the run-up to the Iraq War. Lies that resulted in American deaths and a deeply destabilized world. I think, conceivably, but I would love to hear your thoughts, one could make the argument that Trump has actually reduced the efficacy of lying. It's, I think, in many respects, lost its effect, lost its design. The most sinister, worrisome kind of lying is lying pointed at a subversive aim, or, you know, his lying is repeated and serial, generalized and eternal. He came to his job as a self-confessed liar. And he was in the job, got elected, because enough Americans actually regarded Hillary Clinton to be a more sinister and effective liar. And, you know, you could argue he hasn't been terribly effective with his lies. And, you know, again, to be serious for a moment, and I do this without any kind of partisan agenda or sense of disrespect, but I think, you know, there's every good reason to believe that we might actually be dealing with somebody who is genuinely mentally ill. And when, if we're going to take that prospect seriously, and I think we need to, irrespective of whether we're Republicans or Democrats or something other, then how one judges his lying, I think, can be framed differently. Not to forgive it or to, to dismiss it, but at least to, you know, recognize that it's a it's a certain kind of phenomenon, and a phenomenon that, because it may owe ultimately to some actual defect, is less worrisome than the institutional, long-standing, and often quite effective lying that has become a part of our political culture for a long, long time. Anyway, I think it does leave us with perhaps a more disturbing question, as I alluded to at the start. Why has truth had such a hard time winning the day? We as human beings, as a human species or whatever, are, at least there's a fair amount of scholarship, some of it done by one or two professors right here at CU that say, you know, human beings, you know, are not actually good or wired to be terribly or consistently persuaded by facts. Betsy Colbert at the New Yorker magazine, I guess roughly a year and a half ago, wrote a review of some scholarship on the topic, and it involved the professor who's here at CU. And perhaps he should take my place on the panel next year, since you all guys will be disgusted with this performance. But the title of the article was, you know, Why Facts Don't Change Our Minds. And it's a phenomenon shared by the left and the right. It's not distinctive to any particular party or any particular individual. Once we become convinced of our own truth, it is phenomenally hard for human beings to have their minds changed about that. And that, you know, however one wants to regard the scope and breadth and lasting effects of Donald Trump's lying, seems like a much more profound issue to reckon with. And based on the scholarship that I've read, has been with us a long time, and thus is likely to outlive Mr. Trump. Thanks very much.
Read my lips, no new taxes. I did not have sex with that woman, Ms. Lewinsky. We are sure that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. That's a paraphrase of multiple lies of one administration. So, you get to keep your own doctor. I had the greatest inaugural audience of all time. The prior president wiretapped my tower. I won't benefit from the tax plan. I'm just going to stop there because I would take up all my time. I would take up all my time. I just wanted to put that out there because. I just had a list of the presidents of, you know, of the last quarter century or so. There were, there's probably not one president that didn't lie about something at some point, whether if it covered his personal behavior or shaded the truth on policy issues. Or engaged as in intense lying to cover up even broader crimes, and I think we know who we're talking about there. So presidential lying has been with us probably forever. I know maybe George Washington. Maybe he was the only one that that didn't lie. But the cherry tree thing was kind of stretching the truth. So who knows? You know. There are, of course, some who want to question some of the founding of the United States and some of its founding documents and feel that there are certain half-truths that may be in there. So maybe it's part of our original sin. But we're at a rather unusual time now, and I think it's not completely and totally surprising that the types of lying that we're trying to deal with, particularly with this administration and that the administrations of the last few years, are sort of it's kind of the bookends of the baby boomer presidencies. And it's kind of interesting that Bob Kerry referred to Bill Clinton as an unusually good liar. And following the infamous "I did not have sex with that woman" comment, the president at the time, when he was being grilled under oath, And he was asked about the relations with Ms. Lewinsky. He said, well, it depends on what the definition of sex is. That was kind of an interesting signifier, really, because it was the, again, while lying has been with the presidency forever, we've moved over the last quarter century or so to a period where the presidents and our politicians try and excuse their lying by arguing that they're not really lying because the definition of certain things that we would already assumed to be a given reality are not the reality that we already assumed that they were to be. So in a sense, our politicians will want to tell us that they're not really lying. You're just kind of delusional because you don't really understand what the actual reality is. And that is actually an ongoing crisis that has been helped engineered by our changing technology. We can pass along memes and stories and things of that nature through social media that are hardly ever fact checked. And because of the technology, we can change the images that we now receive, supposedly from quote trusted sources that are maybe friends of ours, and we don't bother because we're often caught up in our own lives. Caught up in our own lives, that we don't always get we don't always have the time to actually check what is being passed along to us. And so, not only do our politicians lie, our friends and family members help pass along those lies. And what was that old saying that a lie can get halfway around the world before the truth even is ready to start catching up with it? I'm paraphrasing, not lying. So given the technological challenges we have, that leaves it to our guardians to try and stem this lying. And unfortunately, that's where some of our institutions begin falling short, including the one to which I belong, the press. When the media, in its effort to be first and not always be accurate, we fall down on the job. And even if we are not actually perpetrating lies, we may end up reporting half truths that our readers and our viewers start looking at us skeptically and saying, "So the media is lying as well." And it's often called Fox News amongst some of the people here have for years called it faux news, F-A-U-X, and argues that because many of the people there are conservative, that they're pushing out lies. Sometimes that happens, particularly on the opinion shows. So on the news shows, maybe not necessarily, but the skepticism we have for our media, whether it's the Daily News or the New York Post or the New York Times, Washington Post, et cetera, it makes it easier for the politicians, and not just the big man in the White House, any of our politicians, to lie, to deceive their public. And when they are called on it by the media, they say, "Oh, well, that's just fake news." And I live in New York, and I see our mayor, who's a progressive, it's amazing that he sets himself up as a progressive. And he is actually a progressive. That is true, and he sees himself as a bulwark against President Trump, but he will often kind of use some of the same political tactics to push back against relevant, reasonable, and accurate reporting that he just chooses to disagree with. So, in a sense, there is a crisis. There is a crisis because our politicians are lying, and our politicians realize that they can get away with it at this period in a way that they could not have in the past. One of the reasons why Richard Nixon met his political doom was you had a media structure that was, in a sense, somewhat limited. Most people got their information from three major networks, their local news, the local newspapers, and of course some of the bigger papers, the Washington Post, New York Times, and so forth. And there was a confidence in the media that was reporting. And in truth, there were Woodward and Bernstein weren't perfect in their reporting. They made mistakes as the movie The Post showed. But there was belief that an honest attempt in the reporting, that the editors there were pushing back to make sure that the reporting was going to be accurate. And that was also true for our networks. Everybody knows how Walter Cronkite was revered. All of that has now fallen aside, and it is of course harder for the remaining media. I mean, the local newspapers, of course, are all falling by the wayside. So the public is skeptical of the media's role in reporting things. The politicians depend and rely on that same kind of skepticism. And we are also, politically speaking, becoming more and more tribal. So therefore, if you're conservative, you're going to lean towards conservative media. If you're liberal, you're going to lean more to liberal towards liberal and progressive media. We fall into these silos, and if the progressive media is telling us that the conservative media is lying, and the conservative media is telling us the progressive media is lying, people just say, "Well, who am I to believe?" And tragically, it is that much easier then for a president to lie literally about anything. And of course, he now has his own kind of social media tool himself to spread out his own lies and his own perception. And so we have to basically the struggle that we all face then is to figure out how to restore confidence in the institutions that have failed us. And as a representative of one of those institutions, I'm not sure how that is done, and so that is why I'm sadly pessimistic for our immediate future. Thank you.
Good morning. First, I want to just take a moment to a shout out to this whole program, because as a first time being here, it is just so fantastic to be able to go to some of these different panels. In fact, there are a few others that I wish I could go to right now, to hear the cross-fertilization sort of picking up on this of different voices and divergent ideas. And so in the course of what I'm going to say, and I kind of prepared some remarks, but now in light of what other people have said, I'm going to be revising those. But you're going to hear some of these, some quotes. I'm going to cite some of the people that I've talked with or heard through the course of what I have to say. First of all, I just want to ask a question. How many people have never lied? Okay. How many people here believe that your president shouldn't lie? Is there a double standard in that? Okay, so I grew up, as probably many of you did, with the legend of George Washington, you know, cutting the cherry tree and admitting to it, "I cannot tell a lie, yes, I did it." Even though we know that's a legend, a myth, we have that ideal. And also with, you know, the counterpoint, which is that if you lie, you will be caught and things will be worse for you. You will suffer more because you lied. You know, what a tangled web we weave when we first set out to deceive. But white lies were okay. You know, it was okay not to hurt people's feelings, to tell lies. We all do that through every day. But our government, people, heads of state could not lie. I mean, they did, but we called them out on it. And the exception was campaigning, where people were let off the hook for lying, not telling truths, exaggerating things. And that goes back to the earliest days of our country, and obviously long before, where if you go back and you look at Andrew Jackson and his campaigns in the 1800s, they're full of lies. And I remember studying in high school, Abraham Lincoln would say things to one audience and things to other audiences. So there was a big difference between campaigning but then governing, because once you were in government, it was understood that you wouldn't lie, that you were, you know, leading for the common good. And here's a quote from one of our speakers, Ian Milhauser, who's a legal expert, and he said that presidents have been the caretakers of our nation's reputation. Caretakers of our nation's reputation. So just think about that. I've lived and worked in the Soviet Union, in the former Soviet Union. I tend to consider myself a little bit of a Russian scholar. So I want to switch over to the Soviet system, the Russian system, which was in a constant campaign mode. So it was a system, the Soviet Union, based on lies, collectivization, which led to starvation. Stalin show trials, forced confessions, executions, the big lie that if you worked, life would be better, you would get a better life, a feast at the end. And leaders branded opponents as saboteurs, wreckers, enemies of the state. Russia was surrounded by hostile states, countries that wanted to destroy it. People were exhorted to work harder, better, you know, even to denounce their neighbors and their relatives. So Russia today seems to have returned to a lot of these lies and campaigning. The Russian government uses some of the same language that I've just said. They're encircled by enemies. Today's Russian press are branded as working against the state, supported by foreign forces. There are no Russian soldiers marching into Crimea, or that marched into Crimea. These were little green men. There were no Russian regulars in the southeast of the Ukraine. These are volunteers, and initially in Syria, there were no Russian army troops. They were irregulars. So I can go on with this. And most recently, I guess the UK has found some, you know, over 25 different lies that have been circulated by the Russians as to who gassed the Skripals in Salisbury. Ukraine, Latvia, the UK itself, his mother-in-law. But the point is to refute the truth, to lie and confuse the issues, and in the end, people don't know what to believe, or they'll fall back on what they believe, as Joe said, you know, the truths that they believe. So after the Ukrainians shot down the Malaysian aircraft, do you remember that in 2016? There were so many lies and so many misstatements about that in the Russian press that they gave. There was a poll that was done on the streets of Moscow by Radio Liberty, and basically they found the basic response that Russians had was, nobody will ever know what happened there. And they did the same thing in the Netherlands, and they got the same answer. The plane went from Amsterdam and flew over the Ukraine when it was hit down. So all of this has been a campaign the Russian government has been waging, and literally just recently, up to the recent presidential elections in March in Russia, the government TV channels were warning viewers that a high turnout was the only thing protecting the Russian people from annihilation by the West. Annihilation. And after the elections, they announced that they had found, I think, some 15 different countries had tried to hack the Russian election system. There's no evidence of that, and it would have been stupid anyway, because clearly Putin was going to win. But this is not just tied to the presidential elections. Putin is in a constant state of campaigning. And unfortunately, we're seeing a lot of the same campaigning here. And I'm not trying to equate Russia to the United States, because their societies are completely different. You know, we're not killing and poisoning off and imprisoning political appointees. We're not imprisoning and killing our journalists. Last time I checked, we have a vibrant press. But the lies that the Trump campaign used in the build-up to the elections haven't stopped. And never mind that you can see in pictures that, you know, this was not the largest inauguration or larger than the last inauguration. When confronted, what you do is you repeat the lies. Attack the messenger. Fake news. Journalists are losers. Enemies of the people. If you're against building a wall, well, then you're not for securing our country, are you? And then also change the story, you know, give alternative facts, misleading facts, and confuse so we do not really know the answer. And we may not really know the answer because there's just so much information out there. And deflect from other issues. So this is constantly going on. And usually there's a semblance of truth in this. You know, caravans of people coming from Latin America north. Yeah, there are people that are gathered together and they're coming north. They're not exactly the Mongol hordes. It's not, you know, 700 of them are women and children, and they're bandied together for security. And this doesn't have anything to do, really, with the Dreamers. So again, this is all campaigning and rallying support. And I fear that this is just going to continue, you know, back to the question of whether it's the new normal. And the other instances that I can think of lying in the United States that really jump out at me, McCarthyism and the Red Scare. This was again, a big campaign, and lying for the Vietnam War. Again, this was a campaign to keep people support for the war. But the key things that we have going for us are the separation of powers, the fact that we have a vibrant press, and we need to watch these. I disagree with one of the premises that Joe made, which is that this is not different and it's not serious. I think it is really serious, and I think we need to really watch this process, because if we're not campaigning all the time, we're not governing, we're not planning, we can't run our country, we can't run our foreign relations. That's not a campaign. You have to have, you know, strategies and thoughts. And so what really worries me is not so much the domestic campaigning, but lying to Canada and then boasting about it, you know, to the president, the prime minister of Canada. So this is a new degree that really worries me in looking at this. And my career was in public affairs. I worked with the press. I was a spokesperson for the press. And I believed, and I think most of my colleagues believed, that we were in it together. We were working for the same things to keep our democracy vibrant. And the idea that I would lie to the press like Sean Spicer is just... just goes against the grain. So in conclusion, I have a hopeful note. I think that we can rise against this. And one of the things that the sessions that I really enjoyed was a storytelling session. And Claire Murphy was asked at the end about how can storytellers help in contemporary America? And I was thinking more broadly, you know, like, how can we help ourselves in contemporary America get through some of these things? And what she said was to be careful of the toxic stories. You know, you own your own mind. Choose what stories you expose yourself to. And I'm not saying limit yourself to, you know, that one source that you agree with. In fact, I think it's just the opposite. But again, choose what stories you expose yourself to.
Just a quick thought. You're talking about choosing which sources you expose yourself to, and I think that's an excellent point. I would say that one of the problems that we've had to come to face with over the last few decades is that the press's what the press had tried to rely on for about 100 years or so. Let me phrase it this way. I think maybe one of the biggest lies that the press has told itself over the last 100 years or so is that it could do its job and be, quote, objective, unquote. The need and insistence of trying to be, quote, objective and fair in covering stories has led to a spot where you go to a politician says something, and it may be completely and totally counterfactual, but the press is reticent to actually call that a lie. They may, you know, show some other points that seem to reject that particular statement, but the fear, if calling a politician a liar is considered falling down on your job as being objective, and the truth is, the history of the free press in the United States is actually built on the press not being objective. I mean, the earliest newspapers were funded by political machines and politicians. Alexander Hamilton, Benjamin Franklin, and many others. And they were extensions of the political viewpoint of the publishers, which meant that the public, had to do some work. They had to spend their 2 and 3 cents and so forth on picking up publications that had very, very different viewpoints. Some were the Democrat Republican Party, the Federalists, and however many, and the public had to be engaged in what is going on. This is how this story is being presented, and this one is being presented to me over here. Let's work together and see. This one is emphasizing these facts. This one's emphasizing these facts. Exactly what is it? What's going on here? That meant you needed an engaged populace. And somewhere around the latter part of the 19th century, the press tried to go more into this objective direction. And now, this is where we are. The press is trying to be super, super objective, and the public is becoming even more subjective and skeptical of the idea even of objectivity.
More comments? Well, just to add to that, I mean, newspapers had, into and up to the 20th century would often have, in their name, the Democratic, Topeka News or something. I mean, I'm just making this up, but I mean, people knew what each source was, where they were coming from.
Okay. I have a question for you, Margot, that you talked about rampant, brazen, whatever word you want to line in the Soviet Union. You've had a broad international experience, not just in Moscow, but also in Munich, Melbourne, and other places that are democracies. Do you think that political lying is more rampant in the United States than in other democratic countries?
No. I mean, I do not think that. I mean, I think it's I was trying to make a distinction between campaign lying and governing. And but I look, for example, at Hungary, where, you know, a democratic government is increasingly becoming nationalistic and populist. You know, Orban is talking about, you know, the enemies from out and within you know, laying George Soros as a scapegoat for, you know, the ills of liberalism in their country. So no, I don't think it's necessarily, you know, a symptom of our state. In fact, you know, I think if you look at Italy and France and others, there are wide range of, you know, political parties, and they're lying to various degrees. I think I was trying to hold an aspirational feeling that, you know, in order to govern, you have to be believed, and you set, you know, a tone for the country. But we're seeing that, you know, not the case. Marie Le Pen in France, another example. One of the things that I always found was interesting overseas is that, you know, Americans have this sort of independent spirit. It's a healthy skepticism, but sometimes I think it can be an unhealthy skepticism of our government. I mean, when you think about, you know, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you. Yeah, most Americans are like, well, wait a minute. Whereas when we were in Australia, I just remember we were in Melbourne, and essentially the governor of Victoria stood up in front of a group of business leaders and talked about all the things that his government was going to do to help business. Well, in the United States, and they were there and they were pushing him, and in the United States, you want your government to get out of the way. You know, let us do our thing. And so there's not the same skepticism that the government is not there to help you. So I think that also plays into this, that Americans are really quick to also disbelieve their presidents and their politicians if they cross a line.
Okay, something that has impressed me about all three of you is that sort of a theme is that lying's bad. And a question I have for you, I know this because I studied philosophy in college. Plato in the Republic refers to the noble lie. That's one of the foundations of his political system. And basically what he was saying was that there are foundation myths, of which we have some. Our founders were all wonderful, good people, and slowly that's been discarded. Some of Thomas Jefferson's activities and more. But beyond that, you take an example of Franklin Roosevelt before Pearl Harbor. We think that what he believed in his soul was that Hitler was bad and that one day we were going to have to confront Hitler, but the nation wasn't ready to follow him. And so he, through his policies and whatever, can be said to have lied to keep the nation together before it was practical for we as a nation to confront the fascist threat. And you might regard that as a noble lie. Would any of you care to comment on that?
A comment. I'm not sure if I answer your question, but when I was doing a little research on this, I looked into, you know, various things about lying, and I went back to the Ten Commandments, and there is no commandment that says you shall not lie. What it says is you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. And so that's basically taken by scholars as saying that, you know, you're not going to get in trouble for lying, but if you lie under oath, and if you lie, you know, under testimony, and you are hurting other people, then that's considered. So there are gradations of lying just back into, you know, the sort of the Judaic Christian faith, which I found very interesting. So this idea to rally people under a lie that can sort of keep the country together because you're going to need that support later. You know, maybe that was justified at the time.
I mean, I guess it's raising the question of, and I guess going back to the idea of the noble lie, if certain shadings of the truth are appropriate for the quote greater good, and if a president lies to the public because he has for national security purposes, and I'm making a distinction here as a casus belli of trying to go to war under false pretenses. There are times where the president is going to have to lie if he has some kind of information about a potential attack that they're attempting to counteract, and revealing it publicly is either going to aid those who are planning the attack or create a needless panic. That might be a case where the president's spokesperson or the State Department spokesperson, rather than just saying no comment, they may end up actually having to say something that's false. I'm not going to start calling those things white lies or not. I think in the context of protecting the public, there are some times you are going to have to say something that is untrue, and you know, be held accountable at the end of it. After the immediate threat has passed, you expect the president or your politician to step up and say, "Okay, we said this; that was not true, but the reasons were X, Y, and Z." So, in certain cases, yes, falsehoods in the name of public safety and so forth is necessary.
Joe?
I don't think I have anything to say about the noble lie. But I was just sitting here thinking, so I think, right, and probably didn't need the three of us talking at you to have concluded this yourself, right? Political lying has been around a long time. Will be, you know, there are people who've performed it better or more recklessly than others. So we can stipulate that that is a fact of life. I think where there's an opportunity to actually do something about it is, you know, we're not going to reform these folks, whatever party they belong to or whatever aim they're pointed at. But how do we actually address or reduce our own susceptibility to lying? Or our own resistance to the truth. And, you know, that begins to comprise everything from what is the quality of our education, what is the nature of how we raise our children. I mean, if our raising of our children is nothing more than us imparting to them these established and enforceable truths of our own, you know, I do not believe that is a healthy way, or I think it makes us more vulnerable to the position we're in, right? Because lies are ultimately the tools of combatants. And I think we can all agree in this country, we've quite had our fill of combat, political combat, cultural combat, and somehow we have to find our way, forward by reducing that combat, by making ourselves less both vulnerable to lies and untruths, and more open to the possibility, more humble about the idea that ours, the ones we value and cherish and pride ourselves on, are you know, perhaps less true than we'd wish.
If I could add, because I think there are definitely things that we can also do actively to support, you know, checks and balances in government and to make sure that the media stays independent and the judiciary is independent. And, you know, one of the things we can do is we can vote and we can help people vote, you know, drive people to elections. One of the things that I got involved with overseas was being, you know, an independent observer of foreign elections. So when I came back to the U.S., I started volunteering as an, you know, working in polling booths. And my husband and I live in Wisconsin, which, you know, is an amazing state to see how it's going back and forth. And I can get into a whole discussion about that. But I've been campaigning for people. And we found a local election for state legislature. The person that I campaigned for, a woman who ran on the platform to be kind and to help everyone who is less fortunate, you know, won a place that went heavily for the Republican Party and Donald Trump, and it also had been held by a Republican for 27 years, I think. And I also was involved in the election count. Remember, Wisconsin, we recounted our presidential elections. And those are 3 days of my life I will never get back. And I do not advise counting election, you know, votes one by one. But at the end of the day, we found there was no fraud. You know, a few votes went for Hillary Clinton that should have gone for Trump, and vice versa. But that was probably just human error. There was no wide-scale fraud, as had been, you know, been, and it continues to be said happened in a number of states. So, you know, get involved. Find your area that you can get involved, and you know, elect the people that you want. And frankly, you know what? It's not good to have one party dominate the U.S. Congress and also the White House. So we have these checks and balances in a pluralistic system, you know, for a reason.
I think in Margot's introductory remarks, she made a distinction between the lies of the campaign trail versus the lies of the lies of governing, and that we have historically given the stretching of the truth that comes in on the campaign trail a little bit more leeway. I think we may need to rethink that. If that is the case, I think we need to rethink that, because sometimes those lies in the campaign trail have a ripple effect and influence what happens on the governing side. Even going back to 1960 election, where John F. Kennedy talked about a missile gap, which, you know, when he became president, suddenly there was no missile gap, but there was still, you know, a trumpeting up of the military budget. So and even before he became a president, Donald Trump spread the birther lie, which helped him connect with a certain segment of the Republican base that helped get him through the Republican primary. So some of those lies that are made campaign time can still ripple into. And also, you're talking about the recount. You've also got the lie of that voter fraud is so massive that we need two government agencies to look into it and possibly pass regulations that may actually make voting more difficult. So, you know, check those lies that are coming on the campaign trail as well. You don't sleep on any of those.
There are two questions here, and I have kind of a conflation of them. One says, it is assumed that the brazen lying comes from the right. Does the left not also lie? Please be specific. And I think that there has been specificity already, but there's another question. How can the public help to restore honesty in public media and politics? And Margot suggests that the way to do that is by voting. Let me posit, you may not agree with me, but I believe in the 2016 campaign that we had a choice at the presidential level between two brazen liars. And as I say, you may disagree with that. You may think that Hillary Clinton wasn't a liar. I think she was, and Donald Trump certainly is. If you have a choice between two liars, how does voting help solve the problem? I, by the way, didn't vote in the 2016 election because I didn't like either candidate. But
well, one thing I would say is that I think the bar has been raised. I think on can't or lowered. Yes, yes, yes. I'm sorry. Yes, the bar has been lowered, and you know, and I might take exception with you over Hillary Clinton. I mean, I think she made some mistakes and tried to hide them. You know, as a government, a former government employee, the idea of, especially in the State Department, you know, the idea that you would have a, you know, a separate email system that was outside of, you know, controls in the security system and everything kind of boggles the mind. But she was not the first person to do that. I mean, Colin Powell had, you know, and Condoleezza Rice they're looking at had, you know, like, separate emails before they, you know, completely came under the system. Her problem was to, whenever she was confronted with something, was not to just debunk it, but then to try to bury it. And by doing that, you're not being truthful, and you're perpetuating something. And then if you say that someone's lying and call that person, you know, lying Hillary over and over and over again, then that sticks in people's minds. And that's one of the things that our current president has done is, you know, labeling each person, you know, in a certain way. Then those labels stick. So, you know, yes, so name calling, yeah, it's bullying. But the thing is that you know, people don't, and I don't have this quote exactly, but, you know, people don't look for the truth. It's the emotional rage that you know, that drives people to do something. And so so somehow we have to tamp down that emotional rage, and we have to get, you know, help the truth come forward. And you know, let politicians admit mistakes, you know, like FDR, you know, in the you know, whether it's expedient, the noble lie, then be able to come back and say, yeah, I made a mistake, you know, we shouldn't have gone into Iraq, but now that we did, we have to deal with that, or yeah, I made a mistake, I did the wrong thing, and then try to move on, and another issue is to you know, don't let it come down to a political campaign where there are, or a presidential campaign where there are two candidates and they are both equally, you know, seen as suspect or lies, and but rather start much lower and, you know, look at your congressman, your state legislature, your congressional, and through the whole political system.
We had in 2016... the two least popular presidential candidates to ever run for the office. Whether the people who had issues with Hillary Clinton, whether it was just about lying, or whether it was other issues, you know, it's a fact. She was a if Donald Trump hadn't been running, she would have been the least popular candidate. And there have been falsehoods, whether it's various explanations on the emails, or even putting that aside, going back a few years about, you know, taking sniper fire in Bosnia and things like that, silly little falsehoods that are relatively easy to check, but for whatever reason she exaggerates, and she ended up getting this reputation of not being a truth teller, and the truth is, you know, as we spoke about at the very beginning, you know, Bill Clinton was really, really good at that. But he was good at telling falsehoods that did not necessarily, the actual big lying thing did not stick to him politically in a way that it always sticks to, in certain ways, even though Hillary Clinton is paid for her own lying sins, I think she also ended up paying for some of Bill's as well, because the press in a way let him get away with certain things, and then they decided to make sure, well, another Clinton is not going to quite get away with this. But that was a factor of why we ended up with Donald Trump, because if both of these people are lying, you know, flip a coin and see what happens.
I'm genuinely interested in how people feel out there. I know there's no meaningful way that we can get to enough questions or whatever, but maybe there is a way of just, I don't know, random sampling how you guys feel. I mean, maybe so we could do a couple of show of hands. How many people came to this panel genuinely concerned about Donald Trump's lying? And how many people, after hearing these modest presentations, find themselves, upon reflection, equally as troubled by Hillary Clinton's lies? So why do you think that is?
This is bolder.
Right, but it's just not an acceptable answer, right? I mean, why do you think that is? Fair point. Correct. And, you know, that is that's not a Democratic trait. It's not a Republican trait. It's a human trait. But news organizations have actually, you know, right, so the news outfit PolitiFact, right, which sought to, you know, routinely and rigorously fact-check statements by politicians, was not started last year. It was, you know, started more than a decade ago. And that grew out of some genuine concern, right, that lying was rampant, lying was dangerous, and we're going to call people out on it. And enormous resources in news organizations over the last 2 years throughout the campaign and then through the first year of Trump's presidency have been invested in fact-checking Trump's assertions all the time, routinely, every day. Have people found utility in that? Has it served a purpose, do you think? Show of hands. And do you think the consequence? Well, anyway, I'll stop with my show of hands.
Are the costs worth it also? You know?
The cost of that investment of,
yeah.
Right, of resources, right? Because to the extent to which one wants to assign a strategy to Trump's lying, and I know that's a stretch for some to contemplate that he has a strategy. It is clearly, you know, it would be, I guess, the strategy of distraction and chaos, right? If you, you know, seek to disorient people with your lies or distract them with your lies, then perhaps, you know, they are not actually examining or taking the time to examine more consequential things that are going on. And I think it's a fair question of the news media. You know, has it been a prudent investment and expenditure of their resources and time, all of which are ever more precious by the year, to rigorously fact-check Trump? Or have they been, in fact, distracted away from covering what might be more consequential aspects of his governance?
Well, I mean, Joe knows this probably better than anybody here. There are dwindling resources. I think almost every panel, there's been at least some reference to what's been going on at the Denver Post. The Daily News, which got purchased in, which got bought in September from Mort Zuckerman, who had owned it for about 25 years, and it's now part of a corporate publishing entity. And there were many layoffs going on at the end of Mr. Zuckerman's tenure, and that's continued in the new era as well. We keep plodding along as well as we can, and we still remain professionals. But there are fewer hands to try and do some of those kind of things that Joe's talking about. The Washington Post and the New York Times still have extensive resources, but even they have fewer than they've had in the past. So it becomes a much harder job to do. And the truth is, the amount of falsehoods that have been coming out of this presidency are enormous on any kind of scale, and I think that's partly tactical, that he figures to just wear down people with so much information and trying to flood the system with a lot of both falsehoods and outrageous statements and so forth that cause the press to go in various different directions.
There's one last question, and I'm going to answer it myself, and if any of the panelists want to chime in, feel free. The question is, if everybody lies, shouldn't there be more young people on this panel? Haven't older people told the most lies? And my answer is yes, because we've been at it longer. Anyone else?
Well, there actually is a little bit of research into the demographics of lying, and there's not a cumulative accounting, but a real-time accounting. Kids actually fare pretty well, particularly younger kids. Adolescents don't do particularly well. They lie with probably the greatest frequency. But without insulting anyone here, as I look out and as I brush back my graying hair, we old folks don't do terribly well either. I think the second worst category of demographic for routine lying were people over 60.
Okay, with that.
If it's over 60, it just can't be, hey, honey, did you come too?
Well, no, actually, I think it was more likely because they were actually over 70, and they said that they were just over 60.
We are venturing where maybe we should not go. But thank you, panelists. Thank you, audience. This has been great.